Today is Monday, June 27th, 2011. I'm Martin Lemlin, and this is News 101.
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taken to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
In-depth coverage from an alternative perspective.
You're listening to News 101, Vancouver's only live, volunteer-produced, student and community newscast, offering you local, national, and international news from an alternative perspective.
What's left of us? Just a big mistake.
Good evening. It's 5:02. It's time for a full hour of independent news. Today we're going to be bringing you an interview with Kevin Milligan, who's an economics professor here at UBC, and we're going to talk about the HST and try and shed some light on some of the murkier points of the tax, see if we can enlighten you before the big referendum. We're also going to be speaking to Martin Putterman about a revolutionary new tactic for scheduling treatment for cancer patients, as well an interview with Catherine Keyes, a high school student who's won it big on a competition with A&E. All this plus your weekday weather forecast right here on News 101, your source for independent local, national, and international news. But first, the headlines from Free Speech Radio News.
Headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Verdicts in the retrial of the former governor of Illinois are in. A jury found Rod Blagojevich guilty of trying to sell the U.S. Senate seat vacated by President Barack Obama. Blagojevich faced 20 corruption charges all told. He was found guilty of 17, not guilty of one, and the jury deadlocked on the remaining two charges. At The Hague, the International Criminal Court issued arrest warrants today for Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, his son Saif al-Islam, and Libyan intelligence boss Abdullah al-Sanusi. The three are charged with crimes against humanity, including murder and persecution. And the long-awaited trial of the four surviving leaders of Cambodia's murderous Khmer Rouge began today. The elderly defendants are charged with genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. Robert Carmichael reports from Phnom Penh.
The defendants are the last surviving leaders of the Khmer Rouge movement, which is blamed for the deaths of up to 2.2 million Cambodians between 1975 and 1979. The four are party ideologue Nguyen Chia, known as Brother Number Two, head of state Khieu Samphan, foreign minister Yeng Seri, and his wife, the social affairs minister Yeng Tirit. All four deny charges of genocide, crimes against humanity, and war crimes. Court spokesman Lars Olsen says today's hearing, which comes more than 30 years after the Khmer Rouge were forced from power, is highly significant.
Those who are accused of being the political leadership of the country, accused of designing the policies that eventually led to nationwide crimes, are finally being put on trial 30 years after the alleged crimes happened.
Three of the four defendants walked out of court Monday, two citing ill health and one in protest of the court's refusal to accept a long list of witnesses. This week's four-day session is procedural and the trial proper is expected to start later this year. Robert Carmichael, FSRN, Phnom Penh.
The Israeli cabinet ordered the army today to firmly prevent the Freedom Flotilla from reaching Gaza. Gillian Kessler-Diamore reports.
The announcement came one day after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said that Israel's blockade of the coastal Palestinian territory would not be breached. 10 boats are expected to set sail for Gaza in the coming days. According to organizers, the ships will carry nearly 3,000 tons of humanitarian aid and hundreds of civilians from dozens of countries. Some of the boats scheduled to leave from Greek ports have faced administrative delays posed by the Greek government. Activists say this is a result of Israeli diplomatic pressure. Last year, Israel faced international outrage after Israeli Navy commandos killed 9 activists on board Turkish ship, the Mavi Marmara. Gillian Kessler-Diamore, FSRN, Jerusalem.
Israeli officials reversed an announcement made yesterday that would ban foreign media aboard the flotilla from Israel for up to a decade and confiscate their equipment. And according to flotilla organizers, one vessel was discovered sabotaged today. Its propeller axle had been cut. Immigrant rights advocates say there's been another mass kidnapping of migrants in southern Mexico. Shannon Young reports.
Armed men kidnapped what witnesses say were at least 60 migrants who were traveling on top of a cargo train through southern Mexico. The incident occurred Friday just before the train rolled into the station at Medias Aguas, Veracruz. Migrants who escaped told staff at the Brothers on the Road migrant shelter that the conductor stopped the train in an area where armed men were waiting with 3 Suburban-style vehicles. Many ran into the countryside and eventually made their way back to the shelter in Oaxaca. Organized crime groups who control the flow of drugs through Mexico started kidnapping migrants for ransom a few years ago. Mexico's National Human Rights Commission estimates at least 20,000 migrants are kidnapped within Mexico each year. Shannon Young, FSRN, Oaxaca.
25 people are dead in a series of bomb blasts in northern Nigeria. Sam Olukoya has the story from Lagos.
The attacks were carried out on Sunday by motorcyclists who lobbed bombs into 3 beer gardens and fired gunshots into the crowd in the northern city of Maiduguri. More bomb attacks were carried out today. The Boko Haram, an Islamic group with links to the Afghan Taliban, took credit for the attacks and many others in recent months that have killed scores of people. The group wants strict Islamic law in northern Nigeria. Sam Olukoya, FSRN, Lagos.
The Canadian government passed back-to-work legislation Saturday, thereby ordering a nationwide postal strike to end. Aaron Lakoff has details from Montreal.
After nearly 58 hours of debate, the Canadian Parliament voted Saturday to legislate striking postal workers back to their jobs. The opposition New Democratic Party attempted to filibuster the legislation, but it finally passed by a majority vote in the Conservative-dominated parliament. Mail services are expected to resume again in Canada on Tuesday. The government threatened to steeply fine both the union and individual workers if they remain on the picket lines. The union said its workers will return to their jobs with their heads held high, despite the fact that the government forced them back to work with a lesser wage increase than had been previously offered by their employer, Canada Post. Aaron Lakoff, FSRN, Montreal.
For Free Speech Radio News from Tampa, Florida, I'm Nell Abram.
Thanks to FSRN for bringing us those headlines. Daily headlines and their news full newscast can be found at fsrn.org. I'm Martin Lemlin. This Sunday afternoon saw hundreds rally in front of the Vancouver Art Gallery as a show of solidarity for UBC graduate student Rumana Manzoor, who was blinded in an attack by her husband. Manzoor, who remains in a Bangladeshi hospital, was attacked by her husband while visiting her home in Dhaka. Her husband remains in police custody in Bangladesh. The rally, which was organized by friends of Manzoor, reached beyond this particular case and sought to draw attention to domestic violence overall. Dr. Olaf Slaymaker, acting principal of St. John's College, says we need to make up the reality of domestic violence everywhere. It's not to pigeonhole this simply as a South Asian issue. In a statement written by Manzoor for the gathering that was read aloud by the organizers, she expressed her desire to return to Canada, saying, "The courage you've given me at this moment has made Vancouver a second home for me. I hope to come back among you to complete my studies." UBC has established a website to collect donations for Manzoor's medical and tuition fees. Donations can be made at the HTTP address rumana.givecenter.com. Although donations will only be accepted until June 30th, as it is set up to help her with immediate costs. The International Criminal Court has issued warrants for the arrest of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi, his son, and his military intelligence chief today. Although the court stressed that the indictments and warrants of the three men are not proof of guilt, the ICC judge said that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the three are guilty of murder and persecuting civilians. But Libya has essentially dismissed these claims, rejecting the authority of the ICC. Despite having ruled for 41 years, Gaddafi doesn't actually hold any formal office in Libya's political system, so he feels he has no connections to these allegations. This is the second time that the ICC, in the ICC's nine-year history, that it issues an arrest warrant to a sitting head of state. The last was in 2009, when they indicted Sudanese President Omar al-Bashir, who has yet to be arrested. The Canadian government spent this past weekend flexing its majority muscle after a 58-hour filibuster where the NDP did all it could to stall the passing of Bill C-6 and a short stint through the Senate. Canada Post workers are being forced back to work as of 5:30 tonight. For months now, Canada Post and the CUBW have been sparring in the hopes of coming up with a new collective agreement. When negotiations stalled yet again on June 2nd, postal workers went on a rotating strike, cutting off mail service in one Canadian city at a time. 12 days later, the Crown Corporation locked them out, essentially halting the entire country's mail service. With Bill C-6, a four-year contract is imposed on the workers and specifies pay increases, but leaves other disputed matters to binding arbitration, where both sides put forth an offer and a third-party arbitrator chooses either one or the other. Now, union leaders are saying that the government's contract gives workers less money than they would have gotten under Canada Post's last proposal. Although Labour Minister Lisa Raitt says that the bill is meant simply to restore mail service and make sure that our economy is held intact, arguing that small businesses and other organizations that rely on mail service were losing millions of dollars a week. In any case, as of tonight, Canada Post workers are back on the job, and right now it looks like the brief work stoppage is not going to affect the summer's HST referendum. The ballots for the referendum were sent out on June 13th, one day before the postal workers were locked out, so they've kind of been sitting in limbo for the past 2 weeks. But the government is keeping to its planned schedule. If you haven't received a ballot, you have until July 8th to request one. You just need to call this number, 1-800-661-8683. Now, all ballots must be returned by 4:30 on July 22nd, and we're being told to expect the results in August. Now, it's important to remember that voting yes is a vote to get rid of the HST, while a no vote means keeping it in place. Also, in order for the Fight HST campaign to succeed, half the voters in two-thirds of BC's riding must vote yes. If you don't vote at all, it's essentially counted as a no vote. To help us make sense of some of the HST's murkier points, I spoke to Kevin Milligan, who's an economics professor here at UBC, to see if we can't clarify the strong points and downfalls of the tax. Professor Milligan, thanks for being with us today. What do you feel are the main advantages of the HST?
Yeah, there's a number of benefits that British Columbians should consider. First is that a value-added tax like the HST removes a barrier to investment by firms, because the old PST had this penalty for investment embedded in it. And that means we're going to have an economy that grows more, produces better jobs, and is better for the long-term future of the economy. The other main benefit is thinking about the administrative costs and the pain faced by, especially by small businesses, in dealing with a complex two-tax system that we have with the PST-GST system. With the HST, the accounting is streamlined, and we only have one tax to deal with. So those would be the two main advantages.
What were the penalties for investment under the PST?
Well, if you're a company and you're thinking about, say, setting up a new operation in Vancouver, and you had to, you know, get a new building up and going, you had to fill it with office furniture, fill it with computers, you're paying PST on a lot of those things that you're doing even before you started business. So say you're saying about a software company, for example. all that PST, you couldn't recover it. It was just the cost of the investment. In contrast with the HST, when you make those investments in buying new computers, buying new office furniture, you get to claim all that HST back because, you know, that's not tax you're paying on your profits. That's tax you're paying even before you open your door. And so in that way, it encourages investment in new buildings, new facilities, new equipment.
So they'd still be paying the tax initially, but they'd be able to get it back at income tax season.
Well, they actually claim it back more frequently than that. But yeah, they get to claim the tax back on stuff that they bought. So anything that you buy as a company, you pay HST on, you have to claim that back.
Which items are going to be most affected by the HST?
So the other big factor of the HST, beyond this idea of how it affects investments by companies, is how it affects consumers. And the big difference there is that we're covering a lot of services that were previously not covered. So these are things like restaurant meals, haircuts, and other kinds of personal services, typically. And so there's some of those items that are covered now, and you're going to be paying HST on that, whereas the old PST, GST system, you only paid GST on those before. Now, in compensation for that, there's a couple things to think about. One is that we now have legislated a 10% rate in the future. It's 12% now, but it'll be going down in the future according to federal legislation. So that helps out, you know, this mix a bit. You're paying a bit less tax on some things and a bit more on others, and so that helps the balance. The other thing is the British Columbians who are struggling the most, the lower-income British Columbians, get an HST tax credit. And this is, for a family of four, it's up to $920 per year of a tax credit that you didn't get under the PST system. And so that helps out to make sure that lower-income British Columbians are protected under this new system.
How much did you say that tax credit was?
So it's $230 per person, and so that's $920 for a family of four. That's for lower-income British Columbians.
So that would be anybody making less than a predetermined amount of money?
Yeah, the threshold is $20,000. You get the full credit under $20,000, and then it gets phased out above that.
And they would get that credit as well during income tax season.
So that's actually done just like the GST checks that people are familiar with getting. It just piggybacks on that. So you get essentially a bigger GST check every quarter. So that's actually nice, especially a lot of students get those GST checks. So essentially you're going to get a much bigger combined now GST and HST check every quarter from provincial and federal governments.
What will be the tangible differences that we'll see with the 2% drop coming in the next couple of years?
Yeah, so imagine you're buying a new computer for school or an iPad for school or something like that. Before, under the GST PST system, you're paying 5% federal GST and 7% PST. Under the new HST system, you're right now paying 12%, so it actually hasn't changed. It's important to note that you're not paying anything more right now. But as of next July, it's legislated to go down to 11%, and then July 2014, when we get there, down to 10%. And so what that means is you're actually paying 10% HST on your iPad versus 12% GST PST.
Do you see any downfalls in the HST?
Yeah, well, a couple of things to keep in mind. First is on the economic benefit side and thinking about the future growth of the economy, there's 140 countries in the world that use this kind of value-added tax system, and no one outside some places in Canada and the U.S. uses the old-style PST tax. And so there's really no downside. Economists are united in the belief that this kind of tax is much better for the economy. Where there is some legitimate grounds for debate is on the fairness side of things. Is this tax fair for all British Columbians? And, you know, I think that with the rate going down a bit and also with the HST tax credit, that really makes the case a lot easier to make that this is a fair tax to make. And but, you know, there are some people who would like a different package there. But, you know, I think that if you look carefully at what's on the table, it's a good package.
So who's getting the short end of the stick with regards to fairness?
You know, people have different opinions on that. It depends a bit on what you spend your money on. If you're someone who likes to go out to restaurant meals a lot, likes to get a lot of haircuts or other personal services, you're someone who's going to bear a bit more of the cost. On the other hand, you know, if you're someone who likes to cook at home and you know, food at by grocery stores is exempt from the HST. So, you know, you're not going to be paying as much as someone who eats out a lot.
So the independent panel that everyone has been hearing about, they estimated that the annual cost for the average BC family will be an extra $350 a year. How do they get at this number, and does it seem accurate to you?
Yeah, so I've had a look at those numbers, and that number was at the 12% rate, which is what we're paying right now. So that number would improve if we go down to the 10% rate in the future. But the way they get that number is they look at the HST you pay on the new things that are newly taxable, those would be the services, the restaurant meals, things like that that weren't taxed before. And they then also look at how the cost savings that business receive will be passed on to consumers. And they make an estimation of how much of those cost savings are passed on to consumers, compare it to how much new tax you're paying, and that's how they come up with that number you see there.
It seems more or less accurate.
I'm pretty confident with that number.
What would be the cost of reinstating the PST, even putting aside the $1.6 billion owed to the federal government?
And this is an important thing to keep in mind as well. There is really a very large transition cost. So the federal government paid us as a transition bonus $1.6 billion, and that would most likely have to be paid back. But as important, there's the cost of reinstating an entire bureaucracy in Victoria to collect the PST. So there'd be 300 tax auditors that would have to be hired, retrained, and that's a big cost. But even worse than that is the cost for small business and large businesses as well across BC, who have to put in place administrative systems to deal with a very complex and confusing PST system. And that burden is actually quite heavy, and that's part of the reason why a transition back would actually take, according to the independent panel, 18 to 24 months. And I think that's a very reasonable estimate. It's not as simple as flipping a couple buttons on a computer to reprogram things. Entire administrative systems have to be put back in place, and that's not something that will happen quickly.
How much of a burden would such an expenditure put on BC's economy?
So I think the biggest burden, the way to think about it, is we're going to be spending, if we choose to go back, we're spending the next 18 to 24 months fiddling around, putting back in place, you know, trying to put Humpty Dumpty back together again, you know, putting together this old tax system again, as opposed to concentrating on the needs of the future, improving our health system, improving our education system, and also improving the life for lower-income British Columbians. I mean, going back to the PST is not something that helps out lower-income British Columbians. We could be designing better social programs, designing lots of other things, spending our energy as a society in better ways than trying to put together, a rickety old tax system like the PST.
Well, thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Milligan. We appreciate it to no end.
Thank you.
Have a good day.
Bye-bye.
Kevin Milligan is an associate professor of economics here at the University of British Columbia. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemelin. Just a friendly reminder that if you don't get your HST ballot in the mail the next couple of days once the post office gets together, that you need to register to vote by July 8th at midnight. The number to do that again is 1-800-661-8683. All ballots are to be in on July 22nd, no later than 4:30 p.m. In a minute here, we're going to talk about an outstanding new tactic for scheduling chemo patients and their treatment. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
You know, Joe, you start with these riffs in your head.
We're good.
And something you want to say, and you want to spin gold, but the thing is, people don't want your sounds. They only want...
You people, you're the fucking coolest!
What is that? What is it? One more shot, a salute.
Tune in to Sore Throats and Clapping Hands, hosted by Robert Privet, Monday evenings at 6:30 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
And in the end, it's love. And in the end, it's love.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. We're broadcasting live from the Student Union Building here on campus at UBC. I'm Martin Lemelin. Needless to say, cancer patients have to put up with quite a bit of stress, and it must sometimes be unbearable to add the headaches of last-minute scheduling for treatments. Now, luckily, the stress of scheduling chemotherapy has been dramatically reduced by a new technology that was developed by researchers from the Sauder School of Business right here at UBC with the help of the BC Cancer Agency. Now, it's called the Chemo Smart Book. and was recently presented an Excellence in BC Healthcare Award under the category of Top Innovation. Since it was launched in June of last year, the SmartBook has reduced the number of patients that get less than 7 days notice for treatment by an astounding 58% and decreased the number of waitlist patients overall by 84%. Now, I had a chance to speak with one of the top researchers for this revolutionary scheduling system, Dr. Martin Putterman, a professor of the Souder School of Business right here at UBC. Well, Dr. Putterman, thank you very much for joining us here. We'll start off, what is the Chemo Smart Book? What does it do?
So, very simply, Chemo Smart Book automates the scheduling of chemotherapy patients. So, in the past, this was a major problem because patients were finding out roughly a day in advance when their appointments would be, which was created a lot of problems and stress for them because chemotherapy is one of the ways that people get treated for cancer. And when people have cancer, they are under great stress, and adding any kind of stress from the system really is something that shouldn't exist.
So the SmartBook essentially automates the process of checking, you know, blood types and other variables and things like that, and shuffles it around automatically so that nurses don't have to.
What happens with chemotherapy is there's about 600 different ways it can be delivered. There's different drugs and delivered in different combinations at different time intervals. And the work for scheduling in the past was each day several clerks in the chemotherapy unit had to put together a schedule for the next day, more or less. And what was happening is patients were finding out about this very late. So here was an opportunity, if we could automate the process of letting patients know further in advance, which was the original objective of the study, so that patients would know roughly a week in advance when they were going to be treated.
So not only does it give the patient a peace of mind, knowing a week in advance when their treatment is going to come, but it also frees up the nursing staff to do other essential duties, right?
Frees up the clerical staff to start thinking strategically. Instead of spending their days with paper sheets in front of them trying to fit in this appointment here and moving every other appointment, and we're talking about 65 appointments scheduled to 8 or 9 nurses, and appointments ranging from 15 minutes up, or about 30 minutes up to 6 to 8 hours, and also trying to keep patient time preferences into account and balancing pharmacy schedules. It's imagine playing, it's like doing a jigsaw puzzle on the fly with the rules changing every minute, and every day on a sheet of paper. So what we did is using a lot of the techniques that we study in the Souder School of Business, using mathematical models to improve how you do business.
How did this pursuit come about? Where did the idea come from?
Well, the problem came from the fact that my wife has breast cancer, and I've spent a lot of time with her at the cancer agency, and I've learned about how the system worked. And I thought, using what I know as a professor at the business school, that we could put some of what we do teach and what we study and what we do research on, put it into practice and help to affect the lives of patients who have cancer.
And who worked on the project with you?
Myself, and we had 3 graduates from the Souder School of Business now work at the cancer agency. So these were students who did what's called the MMOR program, the Masters of Management and Operations Research program. And they all studied at UBC over the past several years and had joined me and now work with me at the cancer agency.
Who funds the cancer agency?
So they're funded now by a research grant from what's called the Canadian Institute for Health Research, and that money goes to pay their salaries, and they're based in the cancer agency, so they're able to work with all the staff there. And this was not just the effort of this team of students, of ex-students, excuse me, but also we work very closely with oncologists and with the staff, other staff of the agency, the pharmacists, nurses, schedulers, and a lot of managers and directors throughout the agency.
So everyone who worked on it, they were all graduates?
They had done master's degrees, yes. Three of the students, they had completed their master's degrees, one about 2 years ago, one 3 years ago, one about 5 or 6 years ago.
And how did they feel about, you know, presumably their first chance to change the face of Canadian healthcare for the better?
I mean, that's why they got into this. I think all three of them were engineers before, and they were looking for something to do that would be very tangible and where they could really make an impact. And it was a great opportunity for engineers to learn about a field that isn't really widely taught at UBC. Some other schools in Canada have industrial engineering departments, but UBC doesn't have one. So students as undergraduates don't really learn about these opportunities. And through a program in the solder school, we were able to promote those, develop this program. And it's what we've been doing all our lives, is sort of using mathematical tools to improve how business was run and how industries run and how service industries are run and the like.
How long did it take you from that original thought and idea to turning it into a reality?
Great question. I mean, we had to sell it. So that took the cancer agency, and try and convince them that this was important, and they endorsed that quickly. And then it took about a year to get it into fruition, and it's been so it started out, say, about 2 years ago and went live last June. So it's been live now for over a year.
And how widely is it used right now?
It's used every day for scheduling chemotherapy patients at the cancer agency, and we're hoping to expand its use, so it will be used province-wide. It's used only in Vancouver right now, let me clarify. And I've presented it at some of the bigger U.S. centers, including Stanford and Michigan and Chicago, and at the Mayo Clinic, and we're trying to find a partner in the States to try it there.
And what have been some of the challenges facing you in this pursuit?
It's a huge problem in the medical system how do you make things more efficient without adding a lot of money to the system? And what we can do is through better scheduling. One, we can get patients into the system more quickly. Two, use resources better. And three, free up a lot of time for more direct patient care and less administration.
Physically speaking, is the smart book a computer program, or is it like an actual separate hardware?
No, it's actually a computer program. It's a piece of software that is linked to a web-type interface. So what was originally a paper system now produces a schedule on the screen. So if you can picture a grid with time slots on the left and across the top of the screen, nurses, essentially what it does is assign patients to nurses in the best way possible. And it uses mathematical tools called optimization methods in the background. But then once it's set up, there's a drag and drop interface, so the clerical staff can move patients around or add patients, or if there's a late cancellation, take that into account pretty easily.
Where does the Chemo Smart Book go from here?
Okay, step one, I'd like to see it used throughout BC. So we've developed it for the Vancouver Center. We'd like to develop it throughout BC. We'd like it used more broadly, and we're beginning to investigate how to do that. Could it be a company? That's a possibility. Could it be a partnership with somebody? That's a possibility. The goal is that our goal isn't only the potential financial gain from it. Our goal is really to improve medical service delivery.
Since it is computer software, it must be fairly inexpensive to install.
Isn't the issue here. What's happening is that every agency does things a little differently. So the program, it's not something somebody can just plug in and work. They have, and that they could do, but it has to link to the computer systems of the agencies, number one. Number two, that we have to make sure that the way that the organization books patients is the same way we book patients, because chemotherapy is very complex. It's not just you go to the doctor, get a chemotherapy appointment, and leave. What happens is that once a patient starts chemotherapy, they might take it for 2 months, 3 months, 10 times, 5 times. It might be 5-6 hour sessions. It might be one. It might be 3 days in a row. So once you've started a patient on chemotherapy, then they have to do it on a very regular basis. The short answer is that it's not that easy to just plug it in. You really have to change what's called the processes at the agency. So it really needs support, and it needs a lot of support throughout an organization before it's actually used.
Do you have any other tricks up your sleeve?
And if there's one message out of this, and it is that you don't really need fancy scientific discoveries to improve healthcare delivery. You need some smart thinking. And a lot of the stuff that's done in engineering, computer science, statistics can go a long way to improving the delivery of healthcare. But the hard part is we have to sell it because the people out there don't know that. So we've been working hard in the business school to develop courses and programs in healthcare management. Because it's the management of the system that's the real challenge. We're not only training people to manage for-profit corporations, but we're really out there to train people to work in the public sector. And a lot of our grads actually go to this, and I've created a new course called Healthcare Operations, which is a master's level course, and it goes through the different areas of healthcare and shows how these techniques can be used.
Thank you very much for joining us, Dr. Putterman. Appreciate it. Have a good night. Dr. Martin Putterman is a research director for the Center of Healthcare Management and the professor of Operations and Logistics Division in the Sauder School of Business here at UBC. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemelin. You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. I'm Martin Lemelin, News 101. We're going to have traffic and weather in just a minute.
Are you interested in radio but not quite sure how to get involved? CITR is the place for you. We are a volunteer-driven campus and community radio station with a variety of volunteer opportunities. Want to become an on-air programmer? Learn about promotions? Maybe become a news or arts reporter? Come learn about all the ways you can become involved at CITR. Volunteer orientations are held on the first Monday of every month at 6:30 p.m. If the first Monday falls on a statutory holiday, the orientation moves to the second Monday. Visit citr.ca for more information.
I'm now going to give things over to CITR's very special weekday weather girl, Jessie Storm. Jessie, can you hear me?
I can, Martin.
What do we have in store weather-wise?
Well, for weather, we're sitting at 18 degrees currently, and the showers are looking like they might come back. It's a little cloudy in the skies. Tonight, we're going to go down to a low of 14. The clouds are going to stick around. The rain might come out again. Monday, we're going to go up to a high of 21. Our Tuesday, to a high of 19. And Wednesday, again, 16. It looks like showers all week. Thursday, again, showers. That's a high of 15 degrees, a low of 11. And Friday and Saturday, surprise, surprise, the sun is going to make an appearance. On Friday, it's going to be 18 degrees. And Saturday, we're looking at a high of 20.
It's pretty good news.
Mm-hmm.
Well, thanks a lot, Jesse.
No problem.
We'll see you next week.
Yeah, see you next week.
That was Jesse Storm with the weekday weather forecast. I am Martin Lemelin. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.
Become a friend of CITR and receive great discounts at businesses around Vancouver. Your Friends of CITR card will net you discounts on Commercial Drive at Audio Pile, Bone Rattle Music, High Life Records, and the People's Co-op Bookstore. You'll also save online at Band March Canada and Big Mama. It pays to be a friend of CITR. To find out more, come visit us in room 233 of the sub on UBC campus, or visit us online at citr.ca.
Welcome back to CITR News 101, broadcasting live from the Student Union Building right here at the campus on UBC. I'm Martin Lemelin. It's been almost 2 weeks since the Vancouver riots, but we just can't stop talking about it, what it means, the possible repercussions for the people who did it, and what they're going to face afterwards. I had a chance to speak with a psychologist, professor here at UBC, Tony Schmader, And she went over some of the mob mentality points, and she hit some very interesting points, and I thought I'd share the conversation with you. Well, Dr. Schmader, thanks a lot for joining us. Well, I'm not a psychology student or anything like that. I'm sure this isn't a new thing, but can you explain to me why it is that we just like to bash things up so much?
Well, I guess that wasn't the question I was prepared to answer. I'm not sure that it is we necessarily like to bash stuff up so much. I guess I would say that, I mean, the way I think about what happened in terms of the riots is that there are several factors that really converged to create sort of a perfect storm to help us understand what went on. One of them is just the high arousal coming from the emotions that we invest in a team that we affiliate with. We know that people rally behind their teams, and of course the build-up to something like a Stanley Cup final is long and very emotional, and they don't come around that frequently. So when they do happen, they feel like this unique moment in time where anything can happen. And we've seen in other cases that regardless of whether or not a team wins or loses, people sort of seem to take it as an opportunity to break the law or to get away with things that they wouldn't normally get away with. So part of it is the high emotion that comes on, and that gives a certain kind of arousal or energy to everybody who's invested in what's happening. Being in a crowd of people amplifies that arousal even more and creates the sense that we're all feeling this collectively. But we also know that the presence of crowds makes people feel less like an individual. And what that means is that they feel less accountable for their actions. They don't feel necessarily, or at least it's not so on the forefront of people's minds, that actions have consequences in that type of situation. Alcohol is another factor that contributes to that. The consumption of alcohol creates something called alcohol myopia, where we literally perceive information differently, such that we're more focused or attentive to what's immediately in front of us, what's happening in the here and now. And it's literally harder for us to process or pull to mind future consequences, future outcomes, other types of possible constraints on our behavior, like laws and norms and just, you know, being a good community member. So all of this kind of comes together to create a situation that's really ripe for people to be influenced by whatever is happening in their immediate vicinity. And when you have a few people, a handful of people maybe even, who come into the city with an intention to start something, it's like lighting a match on a dry kindling. It just sets off this whole chain reaction of events that can lead to what we saw.
I mean, I don't think we can reasonably deny that many of us weren't expecting it. I mean, the anticipation was there. We may not have been talking about it with what happened in 1994, but do you really think it was a case of just a few bad apples lighting that fuse?
Well, I think that someone has to start it, right? I guess what I'm saying is that I'm not so sure that everybody who participated, if you would have interviewed them 24 hours ago, would have said, yes, this is what I plan to do tonight. So I'm not sure that there was forethought probably in some people's minds, but I doubt very much that characterizes the vast majority. I think a lot of people take advantage of the moment. And when I say that, I don't mean in a rational way. I mean that people kind of get caught up in what feels like a party, not theft and violence.
Later on in the evening, on the steps of the art gallery, there was literally a party going on the steps. There was music and everybody was dancing, almost no violence. But right across the street, there was broken windows and stuff on Granville Street. Do you think this is an instinctive thing? Is there any way to right this behavior, or are we sort of stuck with ourselves?
Well, I never think it. I always think it's dangerous to to assume that anything, even if this was instinctual, to say it can't be controlled. So things that are instinctual can still be controlled. So one way to think about it is that just like your car has a gas pedal and a brake pedal, that's kind of the way our behavior is, right? So there are certain things here that are leading us to put our foot on the gas, right? Again, the emotions of the situation, seeing other people doing something and it seeming fun as opposed to something that's dangerous or hurting or harming others and harming the community. The thing that leads people to take their foot off of the brake in the situation, alcohol makes it harder to inhibit our behavior. Again, it makes it, the crowd makes it harder to even just imagine the consequences of our behavior. So you have this case where the unique confluence of the situation has people putting their foot on their brake and or putting their foot on the gas and keeping it far off of the brake.
Yeah, just taking advantage of the situation, I suppose. Do you think that this says something about us as a people in a larger sense?
I think that again, these types of instances, this is they don't happen all the time, but when they happen, they draw this type of attention from all of us because they seem so out of the norm of what we expect from people, right? Really, I think what they teach us is that, you know, most of the time we do all follow the norms. We do all follow laws. We are respectful of other people. We fail to anticipate the degree to which normal law-abiding people can really find themselves under the influence of these types of circumstances that can lead to a sudden and radical change in behavior. It's tempting to sort of to sort of view the folks engaging in these actions and say, "What's wrong with these people?" But the fact of the matter is, we might not. It might be hard for us to know whether or not any of us in the same situation, might have a little fun out of it too.
Yeah.
In the cool-headed, cool-headedness of the following day, it's harder to sort of judge the pressures that the situation has in the moment.
Taking into account the psychology of the individual, do you think there are any preventative measures that we could have taken? Like, you know, maybe in hindsight, putting 150,000 people in the same space wasn't the greatest idea. Because it seems hard to ignore the possibility that this probably would have happened regardless of whether the Canucks won or lost.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and certainly there have been other instances, I think, in Montreal where there was riding after a win and riding after a loss. So there have been other instances like that where it's not so much the outcome that determines what happens. In some sense, these types of episodes can be predicted. They've happened frequently enough that they can be predicted. What do we have in our power to do about them? Well, obviously, controlling crowds and not doing as much to encourage large crowds of coalescing is probably part of just kind of social control that that law enforcement could take. I think there's also an educational component that can happen. That, like I said, I'm guessing that the vast majority of people who took part would not have predicted necessarily that they would have done that ahead of time. Some of them might even be feeling pretty ashamed of themselves right now. But I think there's a way in which having the same kind of media attention that we're having now after the fact, if we had more of that before in the lead-in, so that people were kind of mindful of the dangers of what can happen, what's happened in the past, and take some responsibility for trying to police and control their own behavior as well as the behavior of their friends.
Is there any aspect of the mob mentality that I might have overlooked that you think is important to know?
I tried to touch on the main kinds of things that this all triggers for me in thinking about it. Like I said, I think partly what happens is that, for people in the moment, it really seems like they're in a bubble where different norms apply. And so in the moment, it doesn't. I don't think they see their actions through the perspective of the larger harm that's being carried out
Those of us sitting at home watching it play out on television certainly do, but I think for them, many of them are just, they're just not grasping it in the moment.
So basically you think that most of us are just good-natured people who tend to get a little overexcited now and then?
I guess that's my glasses half full view of the world. Obviously, you can probably find others who will see it differently. As a social psychologist, you know, our sort of whole basic assumption is that situations just have powerful influences on behavior. Most of the time, situations influence us to do good things, but we're drawn to the times when they do the reverse.
All right. Well, thank you very much for joining us. Have a good day.
Sure, no problem.
That was Dr. Toni Schmader, a professor here at UBC with the Department of Psychology. She's also a member of the Canada Research Chair in Social Psychology. For CITR News, I'm Martin Lemlin. You are listening to CITR News 101 right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver. And it's now that time of day where we're going to shamelessly hitch our wagon to the rising star of a very talented young woman from West Vancouver by the name of Catherine Keys. Every year, the television network A&E, which does extensive work to provide informative programming that could be used as a teaching resource in classrooms, they hold a contest called Lives That Make a Difference Essay Contest, which invites students from grades 5 to 12 to write an essay based on someone they think has made an important impact on Canadian society. In this national competition this year, the senior prize from grades 9 to 12 in the women's category went to none other than Catherine Keys, a grade 11 student at Sentinel Secondary School in West Van, and she's won herself the grand prize of an astounding $3,000. I had a chance to talk to Katie earlier today, and we spoke about her recent literary successes. Katie, thanks for being here. How did you find out about the A&E Lives That Make a Difference contest?
Actually, this was my English teacher who found out about it, and she assigned it for all our class. So I can't take credit for going out and looking for extra essays to write, but...
Out of all the influential people you could have chosen, why did you fall on Alexandre Bilodeau?
I was here for the Vancouver Olympics, and I was even downtown at Live City for when he won his gold medal, mm-hmm. which was the first on home soil, and honestly, the entire place erupted. It was an amazing thing to witness. So when I was thinking about who to write for this essay, I definitely thought back to the experience and that, he came to mind. I remember thinking how, you know, incredible a feat it is to be able to unite an entire nation in pride with a personal accomplishment as well. So that sparked my interest, and then when I learned more about his background, he's got a brother with cerebral palsy that he struggled with. He's taken his fame to use that towards cerebral palsy research. He's donated, he's a big advocate for the cause, so I thought that, you know, using that fame as opposed to personal use, he put that to a good use. I thought that was very deserving of an essay.
Did you have a tough time writing it?
I did, just because it was such a short essay. It was only 300 words, and I generally write things like super long-winded and wordy. So I had something like 450 words, and I just had to stare at the page for hours and hours and try to cut it down. But
do you know what some of your friends wrote about? What were some of the other topics in the entries?
A big one, do you know Somali Man? The woman, I believe, who, I think she was a sex slave and escaped, and now she's come to Canada to be an advocate for that cause and bring home the knowledge and the help that she's been able to find in Canada.
You got a pretty pretty honking prize for this essay.
I know.
Have any plans for it?
I plan to take like $300 or $400 out of it just for personal use, and then just set the rest aside for school. I figured I want it in school, I'll put it towards school. So.
Yeah, that's probably a smart move. Your teacher got $1,000 from this because one of her students won the competition. Have you guys started grilling her to spend this money on something worthwhile?
You know, I haven't been privy to this information. I know it's definitely got to go towards the English department and the school. It's definitely not my teacher's money, but I'm sure we'll just get some new reading material. Or
you ever pick up the essay from time to time and soak in the genius of your own words?
I definitely read it after I won the money. I said, okay, you know what? Maybe it's better than I thought. I just kind of, you know, wrote it, handed it in. Okay, that's good. All right, I'm done. But
is this kind of giving you a little pat on the shoulder to pursue some writing?
Yeah, it definitely is encouraging. It's always a tough time to get yourself motivated enough to write an essay that you don't need to write. Mm-hmm. But with this kind of feedback, it's good motivation to maybe do that and see what else can come out of it.
Yeah, well, thanks for talking to us, Katie. Appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for calling.
We'll be watching you very closely. The pride of Sentinel High, West Vancouver in general, Catherine Keys, the winner of this year's A&E Lives That Make a Difference Essay Contest. And that's going to be our program for today, June 27th, 2011. Today's newscast was brought to you entirely by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved with the show, or just give us a hot news tip, you are more than welcome to contact us. Our phone number is 604-822-5334, or you can email us at news@citr.ca. Also, be sure to follow us on Twitter under the username CITRNews. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to past shows at citr.ca. For more news, you can join us right here next Monday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Martin Lemelin. From the entire news team at CITR, thanks for listening. Stay tuned for Sore Throats Clapping Hands at 6 p.m. right here on CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver.